Well, I'll be off. Thank you for coming to the park with me today. It meant a lot to me. I'll look forward to seeing you on Sunday. At your parents' house. She tried her best to inject some enthusiasm into her voice, but Lauren had closed her face back up and recovered her poise. Lovely, she said coolly, and leaned forward to brush her lips against her cheek. By the way, Rachel, Rob said he told you to bring a pavlova, but that's really not necessary. It's no trouble at all, Lauren, said Rachel. She thought she heard Rob sigh. So, now Will is going to make an appearance? Lucy leaned heavily on Tess's arm as they stood on the front porch, watching Felicity's taxi turn the corner at the end of the street. Liam had disappeared inside somewhere. This is like a play. Evil mistress, exit stage right, enter chastened husband. She's not really an evil mistress, said Tess. She said she's been in love with him for years. For heaven's sake, said Lucy. Silly girl. Plenty of fish in the sea. Why must she want your fish? He's a pretty good fish, I guess. Do I take it you forgive him, then? I don't know. I don't know if I can. I feel like he's only choosing me because of Liam. I feel like he's settling for me. For second best. The thought of seeing Will filled her with almost unbearable confusion. Would she cry? Yell? Fall into his arms? Slap him across the face? Offer him a hot cross bun? He loved hot cross buns. Obviously, he didn't deserve one. You're not getting a bun, babe. That was the thing. It was just Will. It was impossible to imagine how she'd maintain the level of drama and gravitas the situation required. Especially with Liam there. But then again, he wasn't Will, because the real Will would never have allowed this to happen. So this was a stranger. Her mother studied her. Tess waited for a wise, loving comment. I assume you're not going to see him in those raggedy old pajamas, are you, darling? And you are going to give your hair a good brush, I hope. Tess rolled her eyes. He's my husband. He knows what I look like first thing in the morning. And if he's that superficial, then I don't want him. Yes, you're right, of course, said Lucy. She tapped her lower lip. Gosh, Felicity was looking particularly lovely today, wasn't she? Tess laughed. Maybe she would feel more resilient if she was dressed. Fine, Mum. I'll go put a ribbon in my hair and pinch my cheeks. Come on, cripple. I don't know why you had to come outside to see her off. I didn't want to miss any of the action. They never did sleep together, you know, whispered Tess as she held the screen door with one hand and her mother's elbow with the other. Seriously? Said Lucy. How peculiar. In my day, infidelity was a much raunchier affair. I'm ready! Liam came running down the hallway. For what? Said Tess. To go fly a kite with that teacher, Mr. Watby or whatever his name is. Connor, breathed Tess and nearly lost hold of her mother. Shit, what time is it? I'd forgotten. Rachel's mobile rang just as she got to the end of Rob and Lauren's street. She pulled the car over to answer it. It was probably Marla ringing for Janie's anniversary. Rachel was happy to talk to her. She felt like complaining about Lauren's perfectly toasted hot cross buns. Mrs. Crowley? It wasn't Marla. It was a woman's voice. She sounded like a snooty doctor's receptionist, nasal and self-important. "This is Detective Sergeant Strout from the Homicide Squad. I meant to call you last night, but I ran out of time, so I thought I would try and catch you this morning." Rachel's heart leapt. The video. She was calling on a Good Friday, a public holiday. It had to be good news. "Hello," she said warmly. "Thank you for calling." "Well, I wanted to let you know that we received the video from Sergeant Belloc, and we have, reviewed it." Detective Sergeant Strout was younger than she first sounded. She was putting on her best professional voice for the call. "Mrs. Crowley, I understand you may have had high expectations, that you even thought this might have been something of a breakthrough. So I'm sorry if this is disappointing news, but I have to tell you that at this stage, we won't be questioning Connor Whitby again. We don't think the video justifies it." "But it's his motive," said Rachel desperately. She looked through the car windscreen at a magnificent gold-leafed tree soaring up to the sky. "Can't you see that?" She watched a single gold leaf detach itself and begin to fall, circling rapidly through the air. "I'm so sorry, Mrs. Crowley. At this stage, there's really nothing further we can do." There was sympathy there, yes, but Rachel could also hear a young professional's condescension towards an elderly layperson. The victim's mother, obviously far too emotional to be objective, didn't understand police procedure. Part of the job to try and soothe her. Rachel's eyes filled with tears. The leaf vanished from sight. "If you'd like me to come around and talk to you after the Easter break," said Detective Sergeant Strout, "I'd be happy to make a time that suits." "That won't be necessary," said Rachel icily. "Thank you for the call." She hung up and threw the phone so that it landed on the floor in front of the passenger seat. "Useless, patronizing, miserable little—" Her throat closed up. She turned the keys in the ignition. "Look at that man's kite," said Isabel. Cecilia looked up to see a man on the crest of the hill carrying an enormous kite in the shape of a tropical fish. He was letting it bob about behind him like a balloon. "It's like he's taking his fish for a walk," huffed John Paul. He was leaned over almost double, pushing Polly on her bike, because she just complained that her legs had turned to jelly. Polly was sitting upright, wearing a glittery pink helmet and plastic rock star sunglasses with star-shaped lenses. As Cecilia watched, she leaned forward to drink cordial from the purple water bottle she'd packed for herself in the white mesh basket. "Fish can't walk," said Esther, without looking up from her book. She had a remarkable ability to walk and read at the same time. "You could at least pedal a bit, Princess Polly," said Cecilia. "My legs still feel like jelly," said Polly delicately. John Paul grinned at Cecilia. "It's okay. Good workout for me." Cecilia breathed in deeply. There was something comical and wonderful about the sight of the fish-shaped kite swimming jauntily through the air behind the man in front of them. The air smelled sweet. The sun was warm on her back. Isabel was pulling tiny yellow dandelions from hedges and sticking them in between the strands of Esther's plait. It reminded Cecilia of something. A book or a movie from her childhood. something to do with a little girl who lived in the mountains and wore flowers in her braid. Heidi? Beautiful day, called out a man who was sitting on his front porch drinking tea. Cecilia knew his face vaguely from church. Gorgeous, she called back warmly. The man ahead of them with the kite stopped. He pulled a phone from his pocket and held it to his ear. That's not a man, Polly straightened. That's Mr. Whitby. Rachel drove robotically towards home, trying to keep her mind completely empty of thoughts. She stopped at a red light and looked at the time on the dashboard clock. It was 10 o'clock. At this time, 28 years ago, Janie would have been at school, and Rachel was probably ironing her dress for her appointment with Toby Murphy. The bloody dress that Marla had convinced her to buy because it showed off her legs. Just 7 minutes late. It probably made no difference. She would never know. We won't be taking any further action. She heard again the prim voice of Detective Sergeant Strout. She saw Connor Whitby's frozen face when she paused the video. She thought of the unmistakable guilt in his eyes. He did it! She screamed. An ugly, blood-curdling scream that reverberated around the car. She beat her fists just once on the steering wheel. It both frightened and embarrassed her. The lights changed. She put her foot on the accelerator. Was today the worst anniversary yet, or was it always this bad? It was probably always this bad. It was so easy to forget how bad things were. Like winter, like the flu, like childbirth. She could feel the sun on her face. It was a beautiful day, like the day Janie died. The streets were deserted. Nobody appeared to be about. What did people do on Good Friday? Rachel's mother used to do the Stations of the Cross. Would Janie have stayed a Catholic? Probably not. Don't think about the woman Janie would have been. Think nothing. Think nothing. Think nothing. When they took Jacob to New York, there would be nothing. It would be like death. Every day would feel as bad as this. Don't think about Jacob either. Her eyes followed a squall of fluttering red leaves like tiny frantic birds. Marla said she always thought of Janie whenever she saw a rainbow. And Rachel said, why? The empty road unfurled in front of her, and the sun brightened. She squinted and lowered the sun visor. She always forgot her sunglasses. There was somebody out and about after all. She grabbed hold of the distraction. It was a man. He was standing on the sidewalk, holding a brightly coloured balloon. It looked like a fish. Like the fish in Finding Nemo. Jacob would love that balloon. The man was talking on a mobile phone, looking up at his balloon. It wasn't a balloon. It was a kite. I'm sorry. We can't meet you after all, said Tess. That's all right, said Connor. Another time. The reception was crystal clear. She could hear the very weight and timbre of his voice, deeper than in person, a bit gravelly. She pressed the phone to her ear as if she could wrap his voice around her. Where are you? She asked. Standing on a footpath, carrying a fish kite. She felt a flood of regret, and also plain, childlike disappointment, as if she'd missed a birthday party because of a piano lesson. She wanted to sleep with him one more time, She didn't want to sit in her mother's chilly house, having a complicated, painful conversation with her husband. She wanted to run around her old school oval in the sunshine with a fish kite. She wanted to be falling in love, not trying to fix a broken relationship. She wanted to be someone's first choice, not their second. "I'm so sorry," she said. "You don't need to be sorry." There was a pause. "What's going on?" he asked. "My husband is on his way here." "Ah. Apparently he and Felicity are over before it's even begun." "So I guess we are too." He didn't make it sound like a question. She could see Liam playing in the front garden. She told him that Will was on his way. He was racing back and forth across the yard, tipping first the hedge and then the fence, as if he was in training for some life and death event. "I don't know what's going to happen. It's just that, with Liam, you see, I have to at least try. At least give it a go." She thought of Will and Felicity sitting on the plane from Melbourne, hands gripped, faces stoic. "For fuck's sake." "Of course you do." He sounded so warm and lovely. "You don't need to explain. I should never have..." "Please, don't regret it." "Okay. Tell him, if he treats you bad again, I'll break his knees." "Yes. Seriously, Tess, don't give him any more chances." "No." "And if things don't work out, well, you know, keep my application on file." "Connor, someone will..." "Don't do that," he said sharply. He tried to soften his voice. "No worries. I told you. I've got chicks lining the streets for me." She laughed. "I should let you go," he said, "if this bloke of yours is on his way." She could hear his disappointment so clearly now. It made him sound abrupt, almost aggressive, and part of her wanted to keep him on the line, to flirt with him, to make sure that the last thing he said was gentle and sexy. And then she could be the one to put an end to the conversation, so that she could file these last few days away in her memory under the category that suited her. What was that category? Fun flings, where nobody got hurt? But he was entitled to be abrupt, and she'd already exploited him enough. "Okay, well, bye." "Bye, Tess. Take care."
"Mr. Whitby!" shouted Polly.
"Oh my God, Mum, make her stop." Isabel lowered her head and hid her eyes.
"Mr. Whitby!"
screeched Polly. "He's too far away to hear you," sighed Isabel. "Darling, leave him alone. He's talking on the phone," said Cecilia.
"Mr. Whitby! It's me! Hello! Hello!"
"It's out of his work hours," commented Esther. "He's not obliged to talk to you."
"He likes talking to me."
Polly grabbed hold of her handlebars and pedaled away from her father's grasp, her wheels wobbling precariously along the footpath.
"Mr. Whitby!"
"Looks like her legs have recovered." John Paul massaged his lower back. "Poor man," said Cecilia, enjoying his Good Friday and his accosted by a student. "I guess it's an occupational hazard if he chooses to live in the same area," said John Paul.
"Mr. Whitby!"
Polly gained ground. Her legs pumped, her pink wheels spun. At least she's getting some exercise, said John Paul. This is so embarrassing, said Isabel. She hung back and kicked at someone's fence. I'm waiting here. Cecilia stopped and looked back at her. Come on. We're not going to let her bother him for long. Stop kicking that fence.
Why are you embarrassed, Isabel? Asked Esther. Are you in love with Mr. Whitby too?
No, I am not. Don't be disgusting. Isabel turned purple. John Paul and Cecilia exchanged looks. Why is this guy so special anyway? Asked John Paul. He nudged Cecilia. Are you in love with him too?
Mothers can't be in love, said Esther. They're too old.
Thanks very much, said Cecilia. Come on, Isabel.
She turned to look back at Polly, just as Connor Whitby stepped off the footpath and onto the road, the kite floating above him. Polly swung her bike down a steep driveway towards the road.
Polly! Cecilia called, at the same time as John Paul yelled, Stop right there, Polly!
Chapter 48 Rachel watched the man with the kite step off the curb. Look out for traffic, matey. That's not a pedestrian crossing. He turned his head in her direction. It was Connor Whitby. He was looking right at her, but it was as though Rachel's car was invisible, as if she didn't exist, as if she was completely irrelevant to him, as if he could choose to inconvenience her by making her slow down if it suited him. He stepped briskly across the road, with every confidence that she would stop. His kite caught a gust of wind and spun in lazy circles. Rachel's foot lifted from the accelerator and hovered over the brake. Then it slammed like a brick on the accelerator. It didn't happen in slow motion. It happened in an instant. There was no car, the street was empty, and then, just like that, there was a car. A small blue car. John Paul would say afterwards that he knew there was a car coming from behind them, but to Cecilia it just materialized out of nowhere. No car? Car. The little blue car was like a bullet. Not so much because of its speed, but because it seemed as if it were on some unstoppable trajectory, as if it had been shot from something. Cecilia saw Connor Whitby run, like a man in a movie chase scene, leaping from one building to another. A second later, Polly rode her bike directly in front of the car and vanished beneath it. The sounds were small. A thump, a crunch, the long, thin squeal of brakes. And then silence. Ordinariness. The sound of a bird. Cecilia didn't feel anything except confusion. What just happened? She heard heavy footsteps and turned to see John Paul running. He ran straight past her. Esther was screaming over and over, a shocking, ugly sound. Cecilia thought, Stop it, Esther! Isabel grabbed Cecilia's arm. The car hit her! A chasm cracked open in her chest. She shook Isabel's hand free and ran. A little girl. A little girl on a bike. Rachel's hands were still on the steering wheel. Her foot was still pressed hard on the brake pedal. It was compressed all the way to the floor of the car. Slowly, painstakingly, she lifted her trembling hand from the steering wheel and wrenched on the handbrake. She placed her left hand back on the steering wheel and used her right hand to turn off the ignition. Then she cautiously lifted her foot from the brake pedal. She looked in the rear vision mirror. Maybe the little girl was all right. Except she'd felt it. The soft speed hump beneath her wheels. She knew with perfect, sick certainty what she'd done. What she'd deliberately done. She could see a woman running, her arms dangling oddly from her body as if they were paralyzed. It was Cecilia Fitzpatrick. Little girl. Pink sparkly helmet. Black ponytail. Break. Break. Break! Her face in profile. The girl was Polly Fitzpatrick. Gorgeous little Polly Fitzpatrick. Rachel whimpered like a dog. Somewhere in the distance, someone was screaming over and over. Hello? Will? Liam had kept asking when his dad was arriving, and Tess had felt all at once infuriated by her impassive role, waiting for Felicity and Will to make their scheduled appearances. She'd called Will on his mobile. She was going to be icy and controlled, and give him his first inkling of the almighty task that lay ahead of him. "Tess," said Will. He sounded distracted and strange. "According to Felicity, you're on your way over here." "I am," interrupted Will. "I was. In a taxi. We had to stop. There was an accident just around the corner from your mum's place. I saw it happen. We're waiting for an ambulance." His voice broke, then became muffled. "It's terrible, Tess. Little girl on a bike. About the same age as Liam. I think she's dead."
Easter Saturday. Chapter 49. The doctor reminded Cecilia of a priest or a politician. He specialized in professional compassion. His eyes were warm and sympathetic, and he spoke slowly and clearly, authoritatively and patiently, as if Cecilia and John Paul were his students and he needed them to fully understand a tricky concept. Cecilia wanted to throw herself at his feet and hug his knees. As far as she was concerned, this man had absolute power. He was God. This man, this softly spoken, bespectacled Asian man in a blue and white striped shirt that was very similar to one John Paul owned, was God. Throughout the previous day and night, there had been so many people talking at them. The paramedics, the doctors and nurses in the emergency department. Everyone had been nice, but rushed and tired, their eyes slipping and sliding. There was noise and bright white lights constantly shining in her peripheral vision. But now they were talking to Dr. Yu in the hushed, church-like environment of intensive care. They were standing outside the glass-paneled room where Polly was lying on a high single bed attached to a plethora of equipment. She was heavily sedated. An intravenous drip had been inserted in her left arm. Her right arm was wrapped in gauze bandages. At some point, one of the nurses had brushed her hair away from her forehead, pinning it off to one side, so that she didn't look quite like herself. Dr. Yu seemed highly intelligent because he wore glasses, and perhaps because he was Asian, which was racial stereotyping, but Cecilia didn't care. She hoped that Dr. Yu's mother had been one of those pushy tiger mothers. She hoped poor Dr. Yu didn't have any other interests apart from medicine. She loved Dr. Yu. She loved Dr. Yu's mother. But John bloody Paul! John Paul didn't seem to understand that they were speaking to God. He kept interrupting. He sounded too brusque, rude almost. If John Paul offended Dr. Yu, he might not try as hard for Polly. Cecilia knew that this was just a job for Dr. Yu, and Polly was just another one of his patients, and that they were just another pair of distraught parents, and everyone knew that doctors were overworked and got exhausted and made tiny errors, like airline pilots, that turned out to be catastrophic. Cecilia and John Paul had to differentiate themselves in some way. They had to make him see that Polly wasn't just another patient. She was Polly. She was Cecilia's baby girl. She was her funny, infuriating, charming little girl. Cecilia's breath caught, and for a moment she couldn't breathe. Dr. Yu patted her arm. "This is incredibly distressing for you, Mrs. Fitzpatrick, and I know you've had a long night with no sleep." John Paul glanced sideways at Cecilia, as if he'd forgotten she was there too. He took her hand. "Please just go on," he said. Cecilia smiled obsequiously at Dr. Yu. "I'm fine," she said. "Thank you. Look how very nice and undemanding we are." Dr. Yu ran through Polly's injuries. A serious concussion, but the CT scan had showed no sign of a serious brain injury. The pink, sparkly helmet had done its job. As they already knew, internal bleeding was a concern, but they were monitoring, and so far so good. They already knew that Polly had suffered severe skin abrasions, a fractured tibia, and a ruptured spleen. The spleen had already been removed. Many people lived without their spleens. She might have some danger of reduced immunity, and they would recommend antibiotics in the case of... "Her arm," interrupted John Paul. "The main concern through the night seemed to be her right arm." "Yes." Dr. Yu locked eyes with Cecilia and breathed in and out, as if he was a yoga teacher demonstrating breathing techniques. "I'm very sorry to say that the limb is not salvageable."
"Pardon?"
said Cecilia.
"Oh, God," said John Paul. "I'm sorry," said Cecilia, still trying to be nice, but feeling a surge of fury. "What do you mean, not salvageable?"
It sounded like Polly's arm was at the bottom of the ocean.
"She's suffered irreparable tissue damage, a double fracture, and there's no longer sufficient blood supply. We'd like to do the procedure this afternoon."
"Procedure?" echoed Cecilia. "By procedure, you mean..." She couldn't say the word. It was unspeakably obscene.
"Amputation," said Dr. Yu. "Just above the elbow. I know this is terrible news for you, and I've arranged for a counsellor to see you."
"No,"
said Cecilia firmly. She would not stand for this. She had no idea what a spleen did, but she knew what a right arm did. "She's right-handed, you see, Dr. Yu. She's 6 years old. She can't live without her arm." Her voice skidded into the ugly maternal hysteria she'd been trying so hard to spare him. Why wasn't John Paul saying anything? The brusque interruptions had stopped. He had turned away from Dr. Yu and was looking back through the glass panels at Polly.
"She can, Mrs. Fitzpatrick," said Dr. Yu. "I'm so very sorry. But she can."
There was a long, wide passageway outside the heavy wooden doors that led to intensive care, beyond which only family members were allowed. A row of high windows let in dust-flecked rays of sunlight. reminding Rachel of church. People sat in brown leather chairs all the way along the passageway, reading, texting, talking on their mobile phones. It was like a quieter version of an airport terminal. People enduring impossibly long waits, their faces tense and tired. Sudden, muffled explosions of emotion. Rachel sat in one of the brown leather chairs facing the wooden doors, her eyes continually watching for Cecilia or John Paul Fitzpatrick. What did you say to the parents of a child you'd hit with a car and nearly killed? The words, "I'm sorry," felt like an insult. You said, "I'm sorry," when you bumped against someone's supermarket trolley. There needed to be bigger words. "I am profoundly sorry. I am filled with terrible regret. Please know that I will never forgive myself." What did you say when you knew the true extent of your own culpability, which was so much more than that assigned to her by the freakishly young paramedics and police officers who had arrived at the accident scene yesterday? They treated her like a doddery old woman involved in a tragic accident. Words kept forming in her head. "I saw Connor Whitby and I put my foot on the accelerator. I saw the man who murdered my daughter and I wanted to hurt him." Yet some instinct for self-preservation must have prevented her from speaking out loud, because otherwise, surely she would have been locked up for attempted murder. All she remembered saying was, "I didn't see Polly. I didn't see her until it was too late." "How fast were you going, Mrs. Crowley?" they asked her, so gently and respectfully. "I don't know," she said. "I'm sorry. I don't know." It was true. She didn't know. But she knew there had been plenty of time to put her foot on the brake to let Connor Whitby cross the road. They told her that it was unlikely she would be charged. It seemed that a man in a taxi had seen the little girl ride her bike directly in front of the car. They asked her who they could call to come and collect her. They insisted on this, even though a second ambulance had been called, just for her, and the paramedic had checked her over and said that there was no need for her to go to the hospital. Rachel gave the police Rob's number, and he arrived far too quickly. He must have been speeding, with Lauren and Jacob in the car. Rob was white-faced. Jacob grinned and waved a chubby hand from the back seat. The paramedic told Rob and Lauren that Rachel was probably suffering from mild shock and that she should rest and stay warm and not be left alone. She should see her GP as soon as possible for a checkup. It was awful. Rob and Lauren dutifully followed orders, and Rachel couldn't get rid of them, no matter how hard she tried. She couldn't get her thoughts straight while they hovered about, bringing her cups of tea and cushions. Next thing, that perky young Father Joe turned up, very upset about members of his flock running each other over. "Shouldn't you be saying the Good Friday Mass?" said Rachel ungratefully. "All under control, Mrs. Crowley," he said. Then he took her hand and said, "Now, you know this was an accident, don't you, Mrs. Crowley? Accidents happen. Every day. You must not blame yourself." She thought, "Oh, you sweet, innocent young man. You know nothing about blame. You have no idea of what your parishioners are capable. Do you think any of us really confess our real sins to you? Our terrible sins?" At least he was useful for information. He promised that he would keep her constantly informed about Polly's progress, and he was as good as his word. "She's still alive," Rachel kept telling herself as each update came. "I didn't kill her. This is not irretrievable." Lauren and Rob finally took Jacob home after dinner, and Rachel spent the night replaying those few moments over and over. The fish-shaped kite. Connor Whitby stepping out onto the road, ignoring her. Her foot on the accelerator. Polly's pink, sparkly helmet. Brake, brake, brake. Connor was fine. Not a scratch on him. Father Joe had called this morning to say that there was no further news, except that Polly was in intensive care at Westmead Children's Hospital and receiving the very best of care. Rachel had thanked him, put down the phone, and then immediately picked it up again to call a cab to take her to the hospital. She had no idea if she would be able to see either of Polly's parents or if they would want to see her. They probably wouldn't. But she felt that she had to be here. She couldn't just sit comfortably at home, as if life went on regardless. The double doors leading into intensive care flew open, and Cecilia Fitzpatrick barreled through as if she was a surgeon off to save a life. She walked rapidly down the passageway, past Rachel, then stopped and gazed about her, baffled and blinking, like a sleepwalker waking up. Rachel stood. Cecilia? An elderly, white-haired woman materialized in front of Cecilia. She seemed wobbly, and Cecilia instinctively put out her hand towards her elbow. "Hello, Rachel," she said, suddenly recognizing her, and for a moment she saw only Rachel Crowley, the kindly but distant and always efficient school secretary. Then a giant chunk of her memory crashed back into place. John Paul, Janie, the rosary beads. She hadn't thought about any of it since the accident. "I know I'm the last person you want to see right now," said Rachel, "but I had to come." Cecilia remembered dully that Rachel Crowley had been driving the car that hit Polly. She'd registered it at the time, but it had had no particular relevance to her. The little blue car had been like a force of nature, a tsunami, an avalanche. It was as if it had been driven by no one. "I'm so sorry," said Rachel. "So terribly, dreadfully sorry." Cecilia couldn't quite comprehend what she meant. She was too sluggish with exhaustion and the shock of what Dr. Yu had just said. Her normally reliable brain cells lumbered about, and it was with the greatest of difficulty that she corralled them into one place. "It was an accident," she said, with the relief of someone remembering the perfect phrase in a foreign language. "Yes," said Rachel, "but Polly was chasing Mr. Whitby," said Cecilia. The words flowed easier now. "She didn't look." She closed her eyes briefly and saw Polly disappear beneath the car. She opened them again. Another perfect phrase came to her. "You must not blame yourself." Rachel shook her head impatiently and battered at the air, as if an insect was bugging her. She grabbed hold of Cecilia's forearm and held it tight. "Please, just tell me. How is she? How serious are her injuries?" Cecilia stared at Rachel's wrinkled, knuckly hand clutching her forearm. She saw Polly's beautiful, healthy, skinny little girl arm, and found herself coming up against a spongy wall of resistance. It was unacceptable. It simply could not happen. Why not Cecilia's arm? Her ordinary, unappealing arm with its faded freckles and sunspots. They could take that if the bastards had to have an arm. "They said she has to lose her arm," she whispered. "No." Rachel's hand tightened. "I can't. I just can't. Does she know?
No.
This thing was endless and enormous, with tentacles that crept and curled and snarled, because she hadn't even begun to think about how she would tell Polly, or really, in fact, what this barbaric act would mean to Polly, because she was consumed with what it meant to her, how she couldn't bear it, how it felt like a violent crime was being committed upon Cecilia. This was the price for the sensual, delicious pleasure and pride she'd always taken in her children's bodies. What did Polly's arm look like right now, beneath the bandages? The limb was not salvageable. Dr. Yu had assured her that they were managing Polly's pain. It took Cecilia a moment to realize that Rachel was crumpling, her legs folding at the knees. She caught her just in time, grabbing her arms and taking her full weight. Rachel's body felt surprisingly insubstantial for a tall woman, as though her bones were porous. But it was still tricky keeping her upright, as if Cecilia had just been handed a large, awkward package. A man walking by carrying a bunch of pink carnations stopped, stuck the flowers under his arm, and helped Cecilia get Rachel to a nearby seat. "Shall I find your doctor?" he asked. "Should be able to track one down. We're in the right spot." Rachel shook her head adamantly. She was pale and shaky, just dizzy. Cecilia knelt down next to Rachel and smiled politely up at the man. "Thank you for your help." "No problems. I'll get going. My wife just had our first baby. 3 hours old. Little girl."
"Congratulations," said Cecilia, a moment too late.
He was already gone, walking joyfully off, right in the middle of the happiest day of his life. "Are you sure you're okay?" said Cecilia to Rachel.
"I'm so sorry."
"It's not your fault," said Cecilia, and felt a hint of impatience. She'd come out for air, to stop herself from screaming, but she needed to get back now. She needed to start collecting facts. She did not need to talk to a bloody counselor, thanks very much. She needed to see Dr. Yu again, and this time she would take notes and ask questions and not worry about being nice.
"You don't understand," said Rachel.
She fixed Cecilia with red, watery eyes. Her voice was high and weak.
"It is my fault. I put my foot on the accelerator. I was trying to kill him because he killed Janie."
Cecilia grabbed for the side of Rachel's seat, as if it were a precipice she'd been pushed from, and stood up. "You were trying to kill John Paul."
"Of course not. I was trying to kill Connor Whitby. He murdered Janie. I found this video, you see. It was proof."
It was like somebody had grabbed Cecilia by the shoulders, spun her around, and forced her to come face to face with the evidence of an atrocity. There was no grappling for comprehension. She understood everything in an instant. What John Paul had done, what she had done. Their accountability to their daughter. The penalty Polly would pay for their crime. Her entire body felt hollowed by the bright white light of a nuclear blast. She was a shell of her former self. Yet she didn't shake. Her legs didn't give way. She remained perfectly still. Nothing really mattered anymore. Nothing could be worse than this. The important thing now was truth. It would not save Polly. It would not redeem them in any way. But it was absolutely necessary. It was an urgent task that Cecilia needed to cross off her list this very moment.
Connor didn't kill Janie, said Cecilia. She could feel her jaw moving up and down as she talked. She was a puppet made of wood. Rachel became very still. The texture of her soft, wet eyes changed, visibly hardening.
What do you mean?
Cecilia heard the words come out of her dry, sour-tasting mouth. My husband killed your daughter.
Chapter 50. Cecilia was crouched down next to Rachel's chair, talking softly but clearly, her eyes just inches away. Rachel could hear and comprehend every word she said, but she couldn't seem to keep up. It wouldn't sink in. The words were slipping straight off the surface of her mind. She felt a terrifying sensation, as if she was running desperately to catch something of vital importance.
Wait, she wanted to say. Wait, Cecilia.
What?
I only found out the other night, said Cecilia. The night of the Tupperware party.
John Paul Fitzpatrick. Was she trying to tell her that John Paul Fitzpatrick murdered Janie?
Rachel grabbed at Cecilia's arm.
You're saying it wasn't Connor? She said. You know for a fact that it wasn't Connor, that he had nothing to do with it.
A profound sadness crossed Cecilia's face. I know this for a fact, she said. It wasn't Connor. It was John Paul.
John Paul Fitzpatrick, Virginia's son, Cecilia's husband. A tall, handsome, well-dressed, courteous man. A well-known, respected member of the school community. Rachel would greet him with a smile and a wave if she saw him at the local shops or a school event. John Paul always led the school working bees. He wore a tool belt and a plain black baseball cap and held up a slide rule with impressive assurance. Last month, Rachel had watched Isabel Fitzpatrick run straight into her father's arms when he picked her up after the Year 6 camp. It had struck Rachel because of the sheer joy on Isabel's face when she saw John Paul, and also because of Isabel's resemblance to Janie. John Paul had swung Isabel around in an arc, her legs flying, like she was a much younger child, and Rachel had felt a searing regret that Janie had never been that sort of daughter, and Ed had never been that sort of father. Their uptight concerns about what other people thought seemed like such a waste. Why had they been so careful and contained with their love?
I should have told you, said Cecilia. I should have told you the moment I knew.
John Paul Fitzpatrick. He had such nice hair, respectable-looking hair, not like Connor Whitby's shifty-looking bald head. John Paul drove a shiny, clean family car. Connor roared about on his grimy motorbike. It couldn't be right. Cecilia must have it wrong. Rachel couldn't seem to shift her hatred over from Connor. She'd hated Connor Whitby for so long, even when she hadn't known for sure, even when she'd just suspected. She'd hated him for the possibility of what he'd done. She'd hated him for his very existence in Janie's life. She'd hated him for being the last one to see Janie alive.
I don't understand, she said to Cecilia. Did Janie know John Paul?
They were in a sort of secret relationship. They were dating, I guess you'd call it, said Cecilia. She was still crouched on the floor next to Rachel, and her face, which had been drained of color, was now flooded with it. John Paul was in love with Janie, but then Janie said there was another boy, and she'd chosen the other boy, and then he... Well, he lost his temper. Her words faded. He was 17. It was a moment of madness. That makes it sound like I'm trying to excuse him. I promise I am absolutely not trying to excuse him or what he did. Obviously. Of course, there is no excuse. I'm sorry. I have to stand up. My knees are hurting. Rachel watched Cecilia rise to her feet with difficulty, look around for another chair, and drag it closer to Rachel's before sitting down and leaning towards her, her brows knitted so fiercely she looked as if she were pleading for her life. Janie had told John Paul there was another boy. So the other boy was Connor Whitby. Janie had had two boys interested in her, and Rachel had been completely unaware of it. Where had Rachel gone wrong as a mother that she'd had such little knowledge of her daughter's life? Why hadn't they exchanged confidences over milk and cookies in the afternoon after school, like mother and daughter in an American sitcom? Rachel had only ever baked under duress. Janie used to eat buttered crackers for her afternoon tea. If only she'd baked for Janie, she thought with a sudden burst of savage self-loathing. Why hadn't she baked? If she'd baked, and if Ed had swung Janie in joyful circles, then maybe everything could have been different.
Cecilia?
Both women looked up. It was John Paul.
Cecilia, they want us to sign some forms.
He stopped and saw Rachel.
Hello, Mrs. Crowley, he said.
Hello, said Rachel. She couldn't move. It was as though she was anesthetized. Here was her daughter's murderer standing in front of her. An exhausted, distressed, middle-aged father with red-rimmed eyes and grey stubble. It was impossible. He had nothing to do with Janie. He was much too old. Too grown up. Cecilia said, I told her, John Paul. John Paul took a step back, as if someone had tried to hit him. He briefly closed his eyes, and then he opened them and looked straight down at Rachel, with such sick regret in his eyes. There was no longer any doubt in her mind. But why? Rachel said, and she was struck by how civilized and ordinary she sounded, discussing her daughter's murder in the middle of the day, while dozens of people walked by, ignoring them, assuming theirs was just another unremarkable conversation. Could you please tell me why you would do such a thing? She was just a little girl. John Paul ducked his head and ran both his hands through his nice, respectable hair. And when he looked up again, it was as though his face had shattered into a thousand pieces. It was an accident, Mrs. Crowley. I never meant to hurt her. Because, you see, I loved her. I really loved her. He wiped the back of his hand across his nose in a careless, hopeless gesture. Like a drunk on a street corner. I was a stupid teenage boy. She told me she was seeing someone else. And then she laughed at me.
I'm so sorry. But that's the only reason I have. I know it's no reason at all. I loved her. And then she laughed at me.
Cecilia was dimly aware that people continued to move through the corridor where they sat. They hurried by or strolled. They gesticulated and laughed. They talked animatedly into mobile phones. Nobody stopped to observe the white-haired woman sitting straight-backed in the brown leather chair, her gnarled hands gripping the sides, her eyes fixed on the middle-aged man who stood in front of her, his head bowed in deep contrition, his neck exposed, his shoulders slumped. Nobody seemed to notice anything extraordinary about their frozen bodies, their silence. They were in their own little bubble, separated from the rest of humanity. Cecilia felt the cool, smooth leather of the chair beneath her hands, and suddenly the air rushed from her lungs. "I need to get back to Polly," she said, and stood up so fast that her head swam. How much time had passed? How long had they been out here? She felt a panicky sensation, as if she'd deserted Polly. She looked at Rachel and thought, "I can't care about you right now." "I need to talk to Polly's doctor again," she said to Rachel. "Of course you do," said Rachel. John Paul held out his palms to Rachel, his wrists upward, as if he was waiting to be handcuffed. "I know that I don't have any right to ask you this, Rachel, Mrs. Crowley. I have no right to ask you anything, but you see, Polly needs us both right now. So I just need time." "I'm not taking you away from your daughter," interrupted Rachel. She sounded brisk and furious, as if Cecilia and John Paul were badly behaved teenagers. "I've already..." She stopped, swallowed, and looked up at the ceiling, as if she were trying to suppress the urge to be sick. She shooed them away. "Go. Just go to your little girl. Both of you." Chapter 51. It was late Easter Saturday night, and Will and Tess were hiding eggs in her mother's backyard. They both held bags of tiny eggs, the ones wrapped in shiny coloured foil. When Liam was very little, they used to put the eggs in plain sight, or even just scattered them across the grass. But as he'd got older, he preferred the challenge of a tricky Easter egg hunt, with Tess humming the soundtrack to Mission Impossible while Will timed him on a stopwatch. "I suppose we couldn't put some of them in the guttering." Will looked up at the roof. "We could leave a ladder somewhere handy." Tess gave the sort of polite chuckle she'd give to an acquaintance or a client. "Guess not," said Will. He sighed and carefully placed a blue one in the corner of a windowsill that Liam would have to stand on tippy-toes to reach. Tess unwrapped an egg and ate it. The last thing Liam needed was more chocolate. Sweetness filled her mouth. She herself had eaten so much chocolate this week. If she didn't watch it, she'd end up the size of Felicity. The casually cruel thought came automatically into her head, like an old lyric, and she realized how often she must have thought it. The size of Felicity was still her definition of unacceptably fat, even now, when Felicity had a slim, gorgeous body that was better than hers. "I can't believe you thought we could all just live together," she exploded. She saw Will steel himself. This was the way it had been ever since he had finally turned up at her mother's house the previous day, pale and discernibly thinner than the last time she'd seen him. Her mood kept swinging about precariously. One minute she was cool and sarcastic, The next, she was hysterical and weepy. She couldn't seem to get a hold of herself. Will turned to face her, the bag of chocolate eggs in the palm of his hand.
"I didn't really think that," he said.
"But you said it. On Monday, you said it."
"It was idiotic. I'm sorry," he said. "All I can do is keep saying I'm sorry."
"You sound robotic," said Tess. "You don't even mean it anymore. You're just saying the words in the hope I'll finally shut up."
She spoke in a monotone. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry."
"I do mean it," said Will wearily.
"Shh,"
said Tess, although he hadn't really spoken that loudly. "You'll wake them." Liam and her mother were both in bed asleep. Their rooms were at the front of the house, and they were both deep sleepers. They probably wouldn't wake them even if they started yelling at each other. There had been no yelling. Not yet. Just these short, useless conversations that travelled bitterly down one-way streets. Their reunion the previous day had been both surreal and mundane, an exasperating clash of personalities and emotion. For a start, there was Liam, who was almost deranged with excitement. It was like he'd sensed the danger of losing his father and the safe little structure of his life. And now his relief at Will's return manifested itself in 6-year-old craziness. He spoke in annoying, silly voices. He giggled maniacally. He wanted to wrestle constantly with his father. Will, on the other hand, was completely traumatized by witnessing Polly Fitzpatrick's accident. "You should have seen the expressions on the parents' faces," he kept saying quietly to Tess. "Imagine if that was Liam. If that was us." The shocking news about Polly's accident should have put everything into perspective for Tess. And in a way, it did. If something like that had happened to Liam, then nothing else would have mattered. But at the same time, it was as if her own feelings were now a trivial matter, and that made her feel defensive and aggressive. She couldn't find big enough words to describe the enormous breadth and depth of her emotions. "You hurt me. You really hurt me. How could you hurt me like that?" It was so simple in her head, but so strangely complex each time she opened her mouth.
"You wish you were on a plane with Felicity right now," said Tess. He did. She knew that he did, because she wished she was in Connor's apartment right now.
"Flying to Paris."
"You keep saying Paris," said Will. "Why Paris?" She heard in his voice a hint of ordinary Will, of the Will she loved, the Will who found the humor in everyday stuff. "Do you want to go to Paris?"
"No,"
said Tess. "Liam does love his croissants."
"No,
except we'd have to bring our own Vegemite."
"I don't want to go to Paris."
She walked across the lawn to the back fence and went to hide an egg near a post, and then changed her mind, worried about spiders. "I should..."